those small thrusters for positioning. Give me some corrections on that pole. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, all the thrusters use nitrogen tetroxide. That's what they use for the oxidizer. They have their rock fuel, and just now I said it before, and I forgot it. It starts with an H. I'll think of it. That's what they use for all their thrusters, you know, to move around. But when they get to the final descent vehicle, the smallest part where the crew is, and that's going to re-enter the atmosphere, that's the one that they say they use the hydrogen peroxide thrusters on. And the reason for it is this hydrazine fuel, they don't want to use it for that, because if there's ever a leak, it's going to get into the cabin, and that would be dangerous for the crew, which had happened at one time. Somebody left a valve open on one of the Soyuz rockets. So, you know, it was actually a vent. It was venting into the system. So they've done away with that for the descent module, and that's why they use these hydrogen peroxide thrusters to orient themselves as they're coming through the atmosphere. And that's why they said the American versions, Dragon and Boeing, are supposed to use a similar thing. And that's why we're also going to have a 240-day limit on our rockets, when we dock with the space station. That's my understanding, but I'll have to look further into it. I've gone back years ago when I used to read about these hydrogen peroxide type of thrusters. I'm pretty sure that that's the way it is.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Back to what you were saying, Dick, about the, when they came through, they did a ballistic entry on that emergency flight. That means they're spinning, they're rotating as they're coming in, you know, heat shield down, but rotating. When normally they don't do that, they glide, they come in like on a more shallow angle, then they ride the atmosphere, they go up a little bit, down a little bit, up a little bit, down a little bit, and then this way they don't have those tough G's. When you come in ballistically, you can go up to 12 G's. They try to avoid that, but in this case, they had to do that because it was an emergency landing. Back to you, Dick.
During that emergency landing, let me jump, I'll check you. During that emergency landing, the rotation you're talking about, I presume it's rotation on axis to give gyroscopic stability of the angle at which they're coming in. In other words, that's an intentional rotation that was done during this abort procedure to keep the approach angle to the incoming air correct. Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, and that's they only did that during abort, and if something else went wrong, I think when they were re-entering many years ago, they had a problem as well. They wound up doing a ballistic entry, rotating each shield down, but normally they want to they ride the atmosphere. It doesn't spin. The thrusters keep them. You could actually angle the spacecraft down a little bit, and it'll go down. You could angle it up, it'll go up. You could go left, you could go right. You could almost direct yourself to a direct location where they want to land, and that's what they do. That's why they land so close all the time. But on something like this, you know, they just happen to get the people down. I think they wound up a couple hundred miles away from where they took off, right near a town.
Tell me about that, near a town. In other words, they were doing no steering because of the rotation. In order to keep things stable as far as a good trajectory coming down, controlling the G's. In other words, the possibility existed that spacecraft could have landed in a Russian town 250 miles downrange from where they were launched. Is that what you're saying, Paul? There's a slim chance that could have happened? In other words, it's not a great big uninhabited area in the steppes where they were landing. WS2N, K2RIW, there's a lot more to the story than we knew about. The news didn't give us these details. You're telling us the inside story, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, Unfortunately, I can't pronounce the name of it. It starts with letter D, and if I did try to pronounce it, any Russians that were listening would kill me. You know, it's just a Dubinsky or something like that, and it starts with letter D. And it's actually one of the locations that after they land, they'll bring the astronauts back to that with the helicopter and prep them, you know, to get ready to go back to either Houston or back to Moscow, you know. Sometimes, you know, they go to the medical tent, they go to the helicopter, and they fly to this town. So it happens to be downrange. So I guess the helicopters, when they came out to get them, they didn't have to go that far. They were only, I don't know, yeah, 50 miles away. So, and it's not like a town, you know. I mean, this is like probably a military, let's call it a military town, you know. Probably like landing in a, you know, some military bases. It's industrial. There's, I don't know how many acres, I think 1,000 acres or something, involved in the launch complex in Kazakhstan. This is not Russia, remember, this is Kazakhstan. It's massive open wilderness. They call it the steppes, S-T-E-P, steppes of Kazakhstan. And there is this one town in that direction where they went. Don't forget, their boosters come down all the time, and they don't hit anybody. But, you know, they're out in the middle of nowhere. But they could if something went wrong.
Quite a story. One of the things that you mentioned, Roy, is that the hydrogen peroxide we buy as a disinfectant, I think it's its primary purpose, a disinfectant. The oxidation, I guess, oxidizes all the bugs when you spread it on a wound or... I guess you could use it like an alcohol rub before you're injecting with a hypodermic needle. Another guess on my part. You're going to correct me on that one. But you said that the hydrogen peroxide we buy in the drugstore is 3%. And I guess the rest of it's inert water. I presume it would be too active and would get us in trouble if they gave us 6%. So 3% was chosen as active enough to be a good disinfectant, but not so active that you get in trouble. What would the trouble be if we had too high a percentage in the bottle that we buy? And if I had the right kind of a prescription, is there a way I could buy a higher concentration if I was foolish enough? AC2GS telling us about hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Well, yes, if you really, really are so inclined, there are sources that are legal and legitimate for higher than the 3% that you can usually get in the drugstore. It's kind of gilding the lily. It's a little too much of a good thing. Oxygen is an oxidizing agent. It destroys things. It kills things. When chlorophyll first came on this world and started to pump it out into the atmosphere, trillions and trillions of organisms died out because of it, because they couldn't deal with it. Fortunately, we use it very easily. But and also, it's explosive, because just think of a large source of free oxygen sitting in your room the next time a spark strikes and you have a conflagration. Getting back to the propellants, though, apparently there's two different types of use for hydrogen peroxide as a propellant. As a monopropellant, it's a very low-efficiency rocket propellant, and they just catalyze the breakdown of oxygen gas, and they use the escape of oxygen as the momentum driving it. The much more efficient manner is to use the oxygen released along with another agent and burn that agent with the oxygen released.
When we use hydrogen peroxide for thrusting, is that a monopropellant, Paul? Is there any time when you use it for minor thrusting, do we use hydrogen peroxide all by itself? Or is it always used with as a binary chemistry with another catalyst? WS2N, K2IW?
I think it's a monopropellant. I've read that before. But that sounds right with what Roy is saying. Yeah, so maybe they're just using it instead of using compressed nitrogen to orient themselves. Maybe they're takes peroxide. They definitely are using a heating catalyst. They said a catalyst, so maybe that separates it somehow, instantaneously pressurizes Maybe they're shooting oxygen out of the these ports. Don't know for sure though, Dick, but I'm trying to go with monopropellant.
Yeah, tell me about, stand by then. Tell me about this heated catalyst. Does that mean if I'm using a monopropellant thruster, I want to do some minor thrusting to orient my spacecraft, I have to turn on a heater first before I can operate that thruster? Is that what you're telling me, Paul, of the S2N, K2IW?
Yeah, but that would be only for this descent module. The other thrusters, they must have 20 of them on board these spacecraft before they separate and leave only the capsule with the, I'm going to call them mono thrusters. I think that's probably what it is. But the other thrusters are, you know, I'm sure they might be hypergolic. They just might react with nitrogen tetroxide and ignite by themselves. I think that's probably how they do it. So, yeah, but they definitely use a catalyst. They use the word catalyst. I'm assuming it's a heating catalyst. You know, I'm adding the word heat in there. I'll have to, you know, research, yeah, the exact way how they do that. I've seen pictures of the little thrusters all over the, actually, no, they look pretty big, all over the descent module when they land. So, I guess they get quite a blast out of it. I just can't imagine it's just pure oxygen, but maybe it is.
Now, I've got a further question for Roy. Let me drop this. Roy, for safety reasons, the hydrogen peroxide we buy in the drugstore is 3%. I presume the rest is inert water, is my guess. And as a disinfectant for the next couple of months that you store it, it's good. If they gave us much higher percentage, there's a number of dangers. One of them, I guess you're saying, is that the oxygen boiling off from the hydrogen peroxide, where it's becoming water, that leaking into the room is potentially an explosive mixture. And so that's a danger. But the hydrogen peroxide itself, in high concentrations, is that a flammable liquid? If I had 98% hydrogen peroxide, is it flammable? Or if I spilled it on the floor and it came in contact with some particular substance, does it become explosive? So tell me some of the dangers that you know of high concentration hydrogen peroxide that make sure we can't easily buy it. AC2GS, K2IW in the tech net.
A6DPZ, Richard, well, you can identify me, okay? You trick with ears.
Okay, Dick. The problem is once again semantics, because unfortunately, although oxygen is explosive, by definition, it's not flammable. The flammable stuff is the stuff that burns in the oxygen. So, and there's lots of things in everyone's house that will burn. Not at the amount of oxygen concentration that we have on this planet, so we're safe. But if you've ever visited a hospital where someone's getting oxygen, there's signs all over the place warning people not to light up cigarettes or matches or anything that sparks anywhere near them, because as you increase the partial pressure of the oxygen, you increase the chance of all these things that we take for granted that are flammable to burst into flame. So that's kind of my take on that. By the way, my understanding is that they use some a silver gauze-like material as the catalytic bed for these things, for the propellant. And hydrogen peroxide degrading into water and oxygen is exothermic. It gives off heat. So a lot of things can accelerate that process. Blood peroxidase in it. If you brush your teeth and you spit into a glass of hydrogen peroxide, it'll fizz because of that.
Dick, will you let me in?
So what is a person spitting that will fizz? Run that by again. Are you saying some people will put hydrogen peroxide in their mouth as a mouthwash after brushing their teeth? Is that what you're saying, Paul? I misunderstood some of those details. AC2GS, K2IW.
K2IW, let me in, Richard.
Yes, there are people who gargle with very low concentration hydrogen peroxide. Also, a kissing cousin is something called glycerol peroxide. It's a glycerin-based peroxide. A lot of times it's used as eardrops to soften earwax, and people use it for gingivitis and such. And blood plasma has a peroxidase in it. So anything that has the slightest tinge of blood on it acts as a catalyst, as an enzyme, to accelerate the rate of peroxides turning into oxygen.
When a patient is getting oxygen therapy, you're giving him a higher concentration of oxygen. It's not the normal 21% we've got in the atmosphere. I am guessing, even when you've got one of those cannulas going into his nose, or when you've got a tent over his bed, you're not giving him, in either case, 100%. I'm going to guess you increase it to 30 or 40% oxygen. Is there a rough number that with oxygen therapy you go to with a patient, but you don't go beyond? Any hints along those lines, Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW?
Well, the general guideline is the lower the concentration that gets the job done, the better. Oxygen, as I said before, is a toxic material. Every so often there's these strange ideas of a canned oxygen that you buy and you breathe to give you energy. Oxygen can cause pulmonary fibrosis. It can cause scar. It's a caustic type of agent in 100% concentration. So yeah, 30, 35, maybe 40, but every time you bring it up, you want to shorten the duration that you have to give these people, because sometimes the medicine ends up being more dangerous than the disease.
Understand. Thank you. All right, so as you can tell, we're discussing Soyuz, space shuttle, International Space Station, hydrogen peroxide. Paul gave us quite a bit of information about all of the above, and those zillions of modules that represent the International Space Station. And in the near future, you're going to have available, by way of Paul and or Roy, a good website where you can go see a diagram of what really is that International Space Station. I'm guessing there are modules that there are probably assembled, not quite Lego, but there probably are toys where you could build a scale model of the International Space Station. I bet you're aware of some of those, and roughly how expensive are they, Paul? So before I send it over to Paul for that answer to that question, toys that allow you to assemble the International Space Station, as I pass it to Paul, I'm going to drag my feet a little bit so that anybody who's got any further questions on all of the above, give me a call that is right now. WS2N to take it with a little delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I don't know if anybody that sells this is got that Hot Wheels used to make up all the different spacecraft that were on the way to Mars. Or it was different. You know, I still have a couple of them, like Sojourner, the one that rode around on Mars, the first robotic mission. I have that with the Pathfinder lander that went with it. Now I don't see anything like that for sale anymore. Now Toys R Us is gone. So the chances of finding something are less. You'd probably have to go on the internet, and maybe they have something. But it would have to be pretty big. And, I'll read off this URL, and, we don't have to do the www, but I'll read it off, www.nasa.gov. Start off with that, /sites, S-I-T-E-S, / vault, V-E-F-A-U-L-T, / file, L-E-S, / thumbnails, thumbnails, / image, image. Let me drop it. / ISS, _, config, config, _, exploded, correction. EXPLODED underscore view, VIEW underscore page, PAGE dot JPG, the JPEG. So that's it. You're going to get an up-to-date, somewhat colorful, a little colorful, not that much, but a little bit. See the solar panels are all like blue. That'll give you an exact layout, an exploded view of this thing.
Almost all of that came through very well, Paul, except there was one dropout. After slash default slash blank slash thumbnail. So in between default and thumbnail, in between those two slashes, what went there didn't come through. Over to you, Paul.
Files, F-I-L-E-S, you know, like a file drawer, F-I-L-E-S, that's the word that comes in between that, www.nasa.gov/sites/default/files/imagine/image/IMAGE/ISS_config exploded underscore view underscore page dot JPG. That's probably the best one on the internet.
And I need a double check on the very beginning. www.nasa.gov/blank/default. Is that STEP? I'm not quite sure what goes in between gov slash and slash default. What goes in that one, Paul? Go ahead.
Okay, sites. So it's lots of, you've got Linux, so maybe you need the first part too, if you have that. https://www.nasa.gov/ sites, S-I-T-E-S, /default, D-E-F-A-U-L-T, /files, /thumbnails, and that's at the end, /image, I-M-A-G-E, /ISS, _config, C-O-N-F-I-G, _exploded, _view, _page, dot J-P-G. And if that don't work out, I'll send it to you there.
Paul, if you email me that long, long, long thing, I'll shorten it a lot and post it places. So just send me a copy, because I was looking on Amazon for the International Space Station models. There seems to be a few kits there.
N2NSJ. Okay, but boy, I'm getting this off the... I actually have a paper that I had printed out a while back. So I'm actually taking it off the paint. I'll have to go on a computer myself to do it. I'm not actually on the computer now. Another station, go ahead.
Yes, N2NSJ. Good evening, gentlemen. I was just listening to the conversation for a few minutes on my drive home, and I don't know if it's pertinent or not, but the Cradle of Aviation Museum happens to have a traveling exhibit, which will be there for the next year, sort of based around Apollo, but it's really designed to talk about space exploration and the future of space exploration. In addition, they have...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We heard, in addition to, we heard the beginning of the Cradle of Aviation. Then we got up to, in addition to...
Okay, I guess I jumped on a little too quick. The Cradle of Aviation Museum has a traveling exhibit for the next year that's based around space exploration and the Apollo program, among other things, but it also goes into future exploration. In addition, there's a model of the ISS hanging, which is built by one of the members in extreme detail. You cannot see inside of it, but it does give you a feeling of the general size and layout of the ISS.
Gregory, you got any balls? You want to talk to me, my friend?
Go over to you, and then I'm going to try to bring this up on the computer and somehow send this to Roy.
Okay, that's some good information. I can see why the International Space Station as a toy is not going to be popular It is so elaborate, it's got things sticking out all over the place that could very easily be broken off. In the case of, let me drop
them. I got about 10 of design, you got a learner.
In the case of an Apollo 5, Saturn V rocket, I can see how you can easily make a model of that. It'd be kind of fun to play with. And even the lunar excursion module, lunar module. But when it comes to something so gangly, with pieces sticking out all over the place that are very long, it can be easily broken off. I can see how that's not going to be a very popular toy. Bunch of guesses on my part. We're beyond the point where we should be over to Roy. I thank you very much, Paul. Very good stuff. And we're looking forward to seeing these diagrams. The more I hear about the International Space Station, I'm always amazed at how big, heavy, large, fast, and so on. One other thing I want to tell you guys. Let me drop it.
Hey, Richard, I'll talk to you when you can tell them, okay, you rat?
One other thing I want to tell you is that if you're in a good location where you've got to, if you use Heavens Above or some other one of these sites that'll tell you when you can see each of these satellites in orbit, if the International Space Station is about to go directly over your house, if it's one of the most desirable flybys, so to speak, and if you're in a place where you can really see horizon to horizon, I believe you can see it for approximately 18 minutes from acquisition of signal to loss of signal, around 18 minutes. Let me drop.
Hello, Richard. Piece of shit.
For that, you can calculate how fast it's sweeping in angle across your field of view. And you would think that, if you choose the right period of time when it's about to go in front of the moon from your point of view and take a picture of it with a good camera aimed at the moon or at the sun, either one, in different settings, of course, by craziness of the camera, with the light of the moon or light of the sun as a background and looking at the International Space Station as a silhouette, and there's been a couple of very well-done photographs where someone has done that, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. When the International Space Station is moving across the sun or moon, they're both a half a degree wide, it takes 3 seconds to go across the whole darn sun or moon. So you'd have to have a very high-speed shutter, very carefully timed. In fact, the people who have caught the International Space Station against the sun, for instance, a beautiful silhouette when you do it just right, they did it with a motion picture camera, so to speak, taking a whole lot of frames per second and hope that one or two of the frames are in the right position of the space station going across the sun. So it's really, at 17,500 miles an hour, it's a very fast-moving object. That's a very difficult picture to take if you're on exactly the right spot. Let me drop. You could say that the International Space Station going in front of the sun is casting a shadow on the ground, and that shadow on the ground is going to be exactly 200 feet wide. That's the length of the space station. It's so close to the Earth. It's only a couple hundred miles above the Earth, and the sun is 93 million miles away. So if the particular dimension of the spacecraft of the International Space Station was 200 feet end-to-end, that shadow on the ground is going to be 200 feet end-to-end. So that shadow on the ground, 200 feet end-to-end, sweeping across the Earth, you have to do some pretty fancy navigating to make sure you're at the right latitude, the right longitude on the Earth at the right time, so you're in the right place. You're going to see it go in front of the sun. You can see how difficult that picture is to take. Okay, I'm going to give you that information because in the past I've wanted to take that picture, or I wanted to see it with my telescope, and I realized how difficult it is to do. We're going to go over to Paul with his science report, and he's going to give us an introduction today that's a little bit different. Don't worry, you're not going to be hearing politics. You're going to be hearing something more scientific than politics. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Roy.
Richard, I'm going to be listening to you. Just had to ask me to come on. I don't like having my dick in the dirt, Richard. K6DPZ.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, Roy here, and
I just want to say a couple little words before we move directly into to science. You know, forgive me if it's a little bit off the subject than I usually do. I don't want to introduce poetry subjects as politics on this net. I do want to point out that Election Day will be upon us once again in a few days, and we've wandered into a very polarized, very emotional, one-way dead-end street on our journey in national politics, so I would not presume to proselytize here and now. I would just like to strongly advise people not to opt out on this Election Day, and that you not listen so much to your heart or your guts or any other portion of your anatomy, but consider using your mind on this Election Day. We live in a world of an abundance of facts and opinions from many sources. Please, don't allow yourself to be victim to a single strident voice. Try and make an informed vote based on many sources of information and opinions. Let the better angels of our nature inside your noggin help you to decide who to vote for. But no matter what part of your anatomy you base your choices on, do vote. No matter what your political ideology might be, it is your right, it is your privilege, it is your responsibility as a citizen of this great country. And now, back to actual science. I just want to remind people that the email address for any topics, questions, comments, statements, what have you, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Everything that I mention, if it's obscured by background noise, will be available by link on roy.ac2gs.com. And we have a little chat room that we maintain that very few people show up for, but I look at no matter what. You can find that at chat.ac2gs.com. Let me drop. In addition, I've already placed on the website a very nice link to a YouTube of a guy with a science degree who bends over backwards to come up with great examples of trying to explain concepts, and his most recent one is trying to explain what electric charge really means. It's not a completed type of presentation. He probably still has other aspects to work on, but it was a fascinating YouTube, and I posted the link. So if anyone is interested, you just have to click and watch at your leisure. Roy.ac2gs.com is where you'll find this all. Let me drop, and we'll move on to the first topic. Okay, we've spoken before regarding the upcoming flu season and that the current vaccines are the best defense that we have at this time. But we might be on the trail of a better solution, just a nose spray away. Now, one of our great members and listeners and participants, Lou NY2H, who is listening on EchoLink right now, forwarded me a link on this subject earlier this week, and the New York Times has also written about this exciting new avenue of vaccine research. Our vaccination technology has its flaws. For one thing, its effectiveness fluctuates from year to year. At best, the vaccine may reduce the risk of illness by about 60%, but last year, during one of the worst flu epidemics in recent memory, that figure was just 40%. And if a new strain of flu were to strike, it might take months to develop an effective vaccine. Plenty of time for the virus to sweep the globe, claiming hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of lives. Let me drop for a second. This past Thursday, an international team of researchers offered a glimpse at something better than the seasonal flu shot. With a sophisticated combination of immunotherapy and gene therapy, they created an artificial antibody that protected mice against dozens of different flu strains. It's an important step towards the type of flu shot that scientists have long sought, a shield against whatever flu strain people happen to pick up. Now, birds host a variety of flu strains, which are constantly mutating and mixing genes into new combinations. Sometimes these viruses manage to infect people, and on occasion, they go on to evolve the molecular equipment necessary to travel from person to person. These catastrophic crossovers can cause pandemics. The worst one, back in 1918, infected an estimated 500 million people and killed over 50 million people. Let me drop for a second. But at any given time, a number of less potent flu strains are circulating, killing as many as 646,000 people worldwide each year. Vaccines significantly reduce the death toll by coaxing the immune system to make protective antibodies. These antibodies seek out the target on the virus, a knob on its shell, called by scientists spikes and also called hemagglutinins. The antibodies attach to the tip of the knob, making it difficult for the flu virus to enter cells. But unfortunately, each strain has a different sort of knob tip. And so an antibody effective against one flu strain often will not work against the others. Making matters worse, mutations can alter strains' hemagglutinin knobs from 1 year to the next. As a result, the vaccine makers have to guess which strain will dominate the coming flu season and plan accordingly. Hope for a better vaccine emerged when scientists discovered that people sometimes produce rare antibodies that work against a range of flu strains. So-called broadly neutralizing antibodies don't latch onto the tip of these viral knobs. Instead, they target different parts that are nearly identical from one viral strain to the next. Let me drop for a second. The authors of the new study wondered if they could string together these broadly neutralizing antibodies into a sort of mega antibody. They isolated four of them, and then they created a gene that manufactured all four as a single mega antibody. The scientists then tested the creation against 60 flu strains spanning the genetic diversity of influenza. The mega antibody grabbed tightly onto 59 strains, preventing them from multiplying in cells. The only thing the mega antibody didn't work on is a type of bird flu that has never been known to infect people. Now that's something that made this quite a unique antibody, said one of the researchers. We saw a coverage that has never been seen before. It would be impossible for a vaccine to coax our immune system into making this artificial creation, so the researchers tried an alternative strategy, sidestepping the immune system altogether. The investigators put the gene into a harmless virus and sprayed it into the nose of mice. The virus slipped into the cell lining, the nasal cavity, and they began producing mega antibodies. Let me drop for a second. Then came the The scientists sprayed flu viruses into the nostrils of the mice, and the team used some of the deadliest strains and delivered what should have been a lethal dose for each mouse. But the new antibodies grabbed hold of the virus and prevented them from multiplying. The treated mice were entirely protected from lethal doses of the flu. But success in mice is no guarantee of success in people. For one thing, the antibodies that the researchers used to create their mega antibody come from llamas rather than people. The researchers gave llama flu vaccines and then gathered antibodies from their blood, including some that were effective against more than one strain. Their choice of llamas was very practical. Llamas and animals have evolved to make very small antibodies, making it easier to snap them together into a mega antibody. Let me drop for a second. Now, it's possible that the human immune system will look at antibodies from llamas as foreign, and if that happens, they might attack, causing potentially dangerous reactions. Human trials will be needed to determine how safe the new antibodies really are. Even if it pans out, scientists would have to know what dose is effective in people as opposed to mice. Science, you gotta love it. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
We need you, GXM. Question?
Yes, GXM.
B2GS, WB2GXM. This is Rich. Roy, you mentioned something about can this new antivirus be administered via a nose spray? Is this what I am understanding? Thank you.
Yes, Rich. The present method is to introduce to mice a genetically engineered virus that manufactures these antibodies in the virus itself. So you infect the mice with a nasal spray. The viruses cause a very, very mild infection, and they produce the antibodies that save you from an influenza infection.
Thank you, Roy. WB2GX, I'm out.
If I understand correctly, Roy, the moist surfaces with a lot of area to them for heating up air and whatever that's in your nasal cavity, that's where the virus would settle, so to speak, and it would there be generating the antibodies. So the antibodies that are giving the benefit would be coming from the surfaces of your nasal cavities. I presume, even though you can do this on mice and get very favorable results, to make sure it works well on humans and doesn't create other side effects, I'm guessing we're a lot of months and years downrange before this is likely to be available to us. Is that true, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW.
Yes, Dick. It sounds very exciting, but you have to kind of understand what's going on with all this research. Just because it works in mice doesn't mean it'll work on human beings, doesn't mean it'll be fatal. It won't be fatal in human beings. Because, again, we're dealing with artificial antibodies engineered from llamas. So who knows how our immune system will deal with llama antibodies coming out of viruses that are infecting our mucous membranes. The mucous membrane is much easier for viruses to infect than our skin. Our skin is covered with dead cells, and so unless there's an abrasion, an irritation, a rash, something that disrupts it, it's pretty much waterproof and it's relatively safe from infection. But the inside of our mouth and our nose has that moist mucous membrane. They're full of live cells. DNA testing very often will scrape those live cells and put them in a little test tube and send them out to be researched. So it's not necessarily that the viruses stay in that little mucosa area. That's their site of infection, and they have a small, far, far less destructive infectious stage where they manufacture antibodies for us. As I mentioned before, there's more bacterial cells in each of our body than human cells. So as long as it doesn't have terrible side effects, there's nothing inherently that terribly wrong with this approach.
If at all possible, we're supposed to breathe through our nose, not through our mouth. And you'll notice that if you do wake up having breathed through your mouth for a lot of hours, your mouth is very dry. And I am guessing the membranes in the nose, one of their purposes is to warm the air coming in and to add moisture to the air, to bring it up to the proper humidity level, making it proper for the trachea and the lungs and bronchial tubes. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. Is that one of the major purposes of the membranes in the nose, to make sure the humidity content of the air you're breathing is correct by the time it gets to the lungs? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, there's a few evolutionary changes that improve our ability of breathing through our nose and not our mouth. The nose really has probably almost identical mucosa membrane than the mouth does, but structurally it's quite different. It has what's called turbinates, which increases its surface area significantly over the mouth. And so it's much more difficult to dry out the nose. You can, if you go to Las Vegas, you know, there's a lot of problems with the humidity is so low there that your nasal cavities and such dry out as well. But it's much more difficult. So the nasal cavities have things called turbinates, which are folds, which increase surface area. And not only does it work to humidify the air going in, but it also acts with the mucus and such to trap any foreign particles that are coming in along with the air.
Okay, now let's take the worst possible situation I can think of, and some human beings have done this. People want to walk across Antarctica. So they're in, minus 40 degree Fahrenheit air, carrying a sledge behind them. Their body is turning out a tremendous amount of horsepower, almost at the maximum horsepower. You can't breathe that fast through your nose. So you're breathing through your mouth, minus 40 degree air, continuously during the hours in which you're trying to it's almost a run, but you're walking across Antarctica with carrying this sledge behind you with all the stuff that's going to keep you alive, your food and clothing and whatever, and your tent and so on that you're going to pitch at night. How in the world does a human lung system survive that situation where you're breathing at maximum rate air through the mouth that has not been properly heated or humidified? How in the world does that stop from freezing the lung tissues? AC2GS, K2LIW.
It works with great difficulty, and if you force it beyond a certain point, it fails and the people die. A lot of people died exploring Antarctica early on when they didn't have the support systems, and unfortunately there's the occasional accident where they still die. So you're getting about to the edge of human endurance, and this is where people, you also get it in people who climb enormous mountains and such, where the oxygen content diminishes to the point where normal people can't really survive the hypoxia. But you know, there's some degree of genetic evolution in the case of mountain people, where they actually have hemoglobin that holds on to oxygen more tightly, and they can suffer hypoxia somewhat better than you or I. But in Antarctica, there's no time for evolution. So you either pack a lot of gear, hope for the best, or you die, unfortunately.
Person who is acclimated for mountain climbing, what changes take place with that human being to give that acclimation? And if you think we're going too deep into medical and we should drop it, it's your choice. Over to you, Roy.
No problem, Dick. I like any topic that has to do with science, and even those that don't have to do with science. But one of the major different physiological changes is the amount of hemoglobin in your blood. There's a certain percentage of hemoglobin, blood cells, along with your plasma and your white blood cells, that you and I have. And if for some strange reason we created more red blood cells than we should have in this environment, the viscosity of our blood would increase, the risks of clots would increase, strokes would increase, it would have an evolutionary impact. But it carries more oxygen. So if you're up there at the tippy top of a mountain, you suffer the increased risk of high viscosity and slightly increased chances of clots at the benefit of being able to breathe somewhat normally. So the primary mechanism we use is simply to increase hemoglobin concentration in our blood plasma. The Sherpas and such went a different route in addition, that they actually evolved a slightly different hemoglobin molecule that has a little bit better hold on to the oxygen. But, you know, again, they had generations upon generations to develop that evolutionary trend, and mountain climbers generally don't. So I understand that some of them actually do give themselves a transfusion of erythrocytes before they try things like this.
There are high-performance sports people who extract some of their own blood weeks before an event, and right at the event, they inject their own blood back into their body, so they have excess blood. Since the rate at which you can oxygenate that blood is a function of lung area, and we're not increasing lung area, are they really doing something beneficial? Although they're cheating, when you inject your own blood back in, does that give a benefit? I'm guessing there's some terrible disadvantages if you overdo it. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Well, in a word, yes, it gives you benefit. They call that blood doping. Just about any competitive sport disallows it. The lung isn't necessarily the bottleneck. What happens with all of us, the more we exert ourselves, the faster our heart rate, the more blood circulates through the lung, through the heart, and the more oxygen we bring to different areas that are oxygen starved. So if you supply more hemoglobin that can carry more oxygen, you have more opportunity to burn more efficiently. You want to burn aerobically, you don't want to burn anaerobically, because it's inefficient and it generates poisonous materials that can cause problems while it's happening and even after you stop doing that. So, yeah, it is beneficial, but it is deeply frowned upon.
If I add up the volume of all of my arteries, veins, capillaries, I can come up with a finite number, X number of gallons of fluid as possible. If I'm now injecting extra fluid, where does that go? Am I getting enough dilation of capillaries that can create extra volume that becomes available when I do this doping? And it looks to me like overdoing it, I think you could get into an awful lot of trouble with high blood pressure or something like that. Over to you, Roy.
Well, you have to understand, number one, they don't transfuse themselves with whole blood. Whole blood is the red blood cells, the white blood cells, the platelets, and plasma. What they do usually is they spin down just the erythrocytes, just the red blood cells. Now, if you go to a hematologist or a doctor, one of the many tests he will give is what percentage of your blood is made up of red blood cells. And let's say 42% for the average guy. In the case of these blood dopers, they would be 55, 56, 70%. Again, it increases the viscosity of your blood. It increases the risk of complications, but it increases your ability to fuel the muscles that you're working on. So you take a chance, and sometimes people have to pay the price, unfortunately. But if you have good kidneys, you won't be fluid overloaded because your body is smart enough to realize that there's too much fluid. The pressure goes up. There are sensors for that, and a whole bunch of systems go into action, and you urinate away the excess fluid and bring down the volume. So unless you're sick to begin with, there are corrective ways of the body dealing with it. They can't quite deal too well with viscosity changes because we're not really designed for that. And that's where sports people get into a lot of trouble.
If the body senses you've got too much fluid and the kidneys try to dump that extra fluid, I don't think the kidneys have the ability to remove the extra erythrocytes. Where do they pile up? If I overdid this, I don't think the body has a clear mechanism by which it can rapidly remove too many erythrocytes if I overdo it. Over to you, Roy.
No, unfortunately, we don't. We're not really designed evolutionarily for that because it's a very, very unusual thing. Now, it's not impossible. There is a disease called polycythemia, which is the overproduction of red blood cells, which is probably the only good reason for bloodletting. Bloodletting was very popular in the old days, and it was about 99% terrible. But in the case of people with polycythemia vera, it actually is one of the treatments for this because our body can't just regularly clear it. It can process it. When red blood cells die, they get processed, and the iron stores get recycled for new red blood cells. But if you give your body too many red blood cells and it's stuck with all this iron, that's another problem that is... We're not good at getting rid of excess iron because usually we didn't evolve in a place filled with iron all over the place. So you can end up with liver damage from excessive iron content. So there's a whole bunch of charming ways that you can screw up your body. You know, evolution is interesting. It seeks solutions to the problems. It doesn't seek the solution to every problem.
In the old days, before medicine became anywhere near as smart as it is today, they used to believe that bloodletting was beneficial when you had a disease, that you were letting out the disease. How in the world did that crazy theory ever get started? Minor question. Don't answer that one. However, people strongly believed at one time that bloodletting is good, and you take a really robust, really great guy like George Washington, the founder of our country, so to speak, our first president. At the end of his life ended because, I've read recently, he had a flu-like disease, he believed in bloodletting, he overdid the bloodletting, and he let...
Repeater, time out.
He literally bled himself to death, and that's how he died. My goodness, was that a crazy belief that bloodletting was beneficial. So if I read correctly, he died because of that, and he would have lived quite a bit longer, I think. AC2GS. I'm out of questions. You can go back to real subjects, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW.
Okay, Dick, but, you know, I find this fascinating as well. I mean, and, you know, I hope I don't bore anyone with the details, but this goes all the way back to Hippocrates. There was this really weak idea that there were humors. There were body fluids called humors. There was blood, there was yellow bile, there was black bile, and there's phlegm. And an imbalance of one or the other would cause symptoms, and so very often they decide because you really couldn't drain bile or phlegm, you could drain blood. So they figured that they would put the balance back by getting rid of some of the blood. And they had leeches, they had all kinds of fun things. But yes, throughout history, you can easily read stories where people probably would have survived their problem if the cure didn't kill them.
Thank you.
Anyone else have any questions or comments about this particular subject before I jump to another one? Very well. Many caveats apply. Let's see. Okay, we brought this up earlier in the year when it was just a preliminary report, but I thought it might be entertaining for people to mention this final results of this study. And some people have been very suspicious of what havoc all these cell phones that we have been using for years might be causing. On this past Thursday, a federal agency released the final results of what experts call the world's largest and most costly experiment to look into this question. The study originated in the Clinton administration, cost $30 million, and involved 3,000 rodents. Yes, rodents. The experiment by the National Toxicology Program found positive but relatively modest evidence that radio waves from some types of cell phones could raise the risk that male rats develop brain cancer. We believe that the link between radio frequency radiation and tumors in male rats is real, John Bercher, a senior scientist at the National Toxicology Program, said in a statement. But he cautioned that the exposure levels and the durations were far greater than what people typically encounter, and thus cannot be compared directly to the exposure that humans experience. Moreover, the rat studies examined the effects of a radio frequency associated with an early generation of cell phone technology, one that fell out of routine use years ago. Any concerns arising from the study thus would seem to apply mainly to early adopters who use those bygone devices, not to users of current models, and particularly those people who happen to also be rats. Let me drop for a second. The lowest level of radiation in the federal study was equal to the maximum exposure that federal regulations allow for telephone use. That level of exposure rarely occurred in typical cell phone use, the toxicology agency said. The highest level was four times higher than the permitted maximum. The toxicology program released a preliminary draft of the study findings in May 2016, saying that the radiation had likely caused the brain tumors. This February, in a draft report, it backed away from that relatively firm conclusion. In March, however, a peer-reviewed panel of 11 experts from the industry and academia voted to advise the agency that it should raise the confidence level from equivocal evidence to some evidence of a link between cell phone radiation and brain tumors in male rats. The rodents in the study were exposed to radiation 9 hours a day for 2 years, far longer than any heavy user of cell phones. For the rats, the exposure started before birth and continued until they were about 2 years old. Let me drop for a second. Some 2 to 3% of the male rats exposed to the radiation developed malignant gliomas, a deadly brain cancer compared to none in a control group that received no radiation. Many epidemiologists see no overall rise in the incidence of gliomas in human populations, though. The study also found that about 5 to 7% of male rats exposed to the highest levels of radiation developed certain heart tumors, malignant schwannomas, compared to none in the control group. Now, malignant schwannomas are similar to acoustic neuromas, benign tumors that can develop in people in the nerves that connect the ears to the brain. The rats were exposed to a radiation at a frequency of 900 megahertz, typical of the second generation of cell phones, prevailed in the 1990s when the study was first conceived. Let me drop for a second. Current cell phones represent the fourth generation, known as 4G, and 5G phones are expected to debut around 2020. They employ much